Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. During the past decade, there's been a long overdue reappraisal of the artistic work of female artists and artists of color. Through this review, many interesting artists and their output have been discovered and rediscovered in all artistic endeavors. My guest today has been involved with this process in classical music. As music director of the Fort Smith Symphony, John Jetter has featured the music of African-American composer William Grant Still in a series of highly regarded recordings for the label Naxos. And now, in their fourth recording for the label, they're featuring the music of Florence Price. Price was the first female African-American composer to have her compositions performed by a major American symphony. And during the 1930s and 40s, she was very active as a composer during a time when American composers were trying to forge their own musical identity. You can hear that in her music. In recent years, though, her music, save her arrangements of spirituals, virtually disappeared. The Fort Smith Symphony's new recording of Price's Symphony No. 1 and 4 hope to change that. In fact, the Fourth Symphony was just only recently discovered in the attic of an abandoned house. And the symphony was the first to perform the music and has now recorded it. John Jetter has led the Fort Smith Symphony since 1996 and has been honored for his innovative programming, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa to talk about the music of Florence Price. John Jetter, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is your fourth recording now of orchestral music of African-American composers. So what led to this recording of the music of Florence Price?
Well, as you just suggested, after the three recordings with the Fort Smith Symphony of the music of William Grant Still, who has Arkansas roots, it made sense to move on to Florence Price, who was born and raised in Little Rock, Arkansas. So it seemed like the perfect connection. And in the case of William Grant Still, him being the first recognized African-American symphonic composer, we have Florence Price, who was the first African-American female symphonic composer to be recognized as such. So it just seemed to make a lot of sense. And Naxos International felt like it made a lot of sense. So the next thing we knew, we were off and running on this fourth recording.
Now, were you very familiar with her music prior to this project getting underway, or?
No. I knew about her. I knew a little bit before, but I was interested enough and fortunate enough in that the largest collection of her music is at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, their library, their special collections, big archive of her music. So I went up there. I spent the day up there with Dr. James Greeson, who was on faculty at the college. He's sort of the resident Florence Price scholar at the college. And we looked through a lot of scores. And after that, I thought, wow, this would make a great recording project.
Now, for those who don't know Florence Price, who was she? Most of her life, she lived in Chicago, right?
Yes. Well, she was born in 1887 in Little Rock and passed away in 1953. She, of course, did music all of her life. She went to the New England Conservatory, which was an attended school there, which was kind of unusual for a female, particularly an African-American, to go to conservatory to get a music degree. And then she, you're right, spent most of her life in Chicago. She moved back to Arkansas for a while, and it's interesting to follow sort of the history of Arkansas, that things for African-Americans were actually better when she was first born and growing up there. And then, unfortunately, politically, things started to go downhill, so that was part of the reason for her to move up north. Everything from what she felt was just personal safety to just more opportunities. And then her biggest opportunity was winning a prize in the Wanamaker Foundation Awards. It was a composer competition, and she won first place and third place. Her first place was for her first symphony, which the prize was, one of the prizes was having that performed by the Chicago Symphony. And that would have been when Frederick Stock was the music director. And that opportunity that she had with the Chicago Symphony, that's really what put her in the history book of American concert music. And when we say she was the first African-American female symphonic composer, there were others before, but not who had the opportunity to perform, have a piece performed by such a large orchestra. And then after that, she did have performances in many places. There was a WPA symphony that was active in the Detroit area that performed her music. But after she passed away, her music just, you know, she became more of an American history, music history name, as opposed to having much of her music performed.
I think probably she's best known for her arrangements of spirituals. I think those sort of stayed in the within that area of performance that was still used, I think.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, there are songs and there are some smaller pieces. She wrote some piano pieces for children. So, yeah, she was, her music was around, but in not any sort of, you know, a big kind of concert hall capacity, you know, as so many other composers, so many of her contemporaries.
And she was writing in the, especially these two works that are in this recording are from the 30s and 40s when composers are trying to find sort of an American school of performance, of compositional style. And I was really interested in how you felt like she fit in, because in one sense, when you listen to her music, it seems a little anachronistic, but it could also be sort of nostalgic, or it could be part of this movement to find an American school of composition. Where do you think her music fits in?
There's no question that her background in music and the influences there of that 19th century tonal Austro-Germanic symphony. When you hear these two symphonies, there's no question that's kind of the backdrop. I absolutely agree that she's trying to find a voice, or she's representing a voice that is all about the American musical experience. No question about it. I should say the American experience.
Right.
And I think, yes, at that time, she musically, it's a very dynamic time. I mean, you've got tonality in many cases is, you know, kind of almost out the window in many parts of the world. But yes, this sort of American school that includes tonality is something that I think for her was a very genuine, sincere effort. I think you're actually hearing her voice, which is one of the things I like about these compositions. To me, they seem very genuine to me. They seem like that's really what she's wanting to say.
Right.
And yes, if you look at what's happening, of course, in the big cities, especially with concert music at that time, yeah, it almost is. He's almost a throwback. You know, Rachmaninoff was a throwback. If you think about it, he was hugely criticized in his life for pieces that we now love. At the time, it was like, what are you doing? You know, why are you writing in a major key? What are you? Are you nuts? But yeah, there's this American school, and I think part of that American school, looking at America's past, I think composers said, you know, actually, if you look at our past and the, sort of the ruralness of it, we're so much younger than Europe. I think there was really a strong sense that we needed tonality to kind of represent. If you want to say a simpler history, you could. But if you think about the American experience, say this, you're talking in 1930s, if you think how it had not gone back nearly as far as the European experience, and we didn't have all that, or so much of the country was sort of, you know, the frontier, so much growth and so much rural activity, that this, for lack of a better word, simpler style, tonal style, seems to make a lot more sense aesthetically.
There's a lot of elements of Dvorak, Dvorak's American music, the New World Symphony, the American Suite, the American Quartet, that seems to be, to have some influence on her. Would you say?
I think so. Well, you know, here you have a guy, Dvorak, who's a complete Austro-German tradition. I mean, totally. With of course, his Czech and Bohemian background as well. He takes all that. He comes to America, is very interested in what's happening with folk music here in America. So you've got that element in his music. Yeah, she's not that far off, because she has that same traditional base, and she's trying to also include the folk element. And especially in that the slow movement of the Fourth Symphony is very similar to the slow movement of Dvorak's New World. So I'm sure she was influenced by him. And yes, I understand the similarities. Maybe because I've been so involved in the music, I don't hear as much Dvorak as maybe has been written about. But there is an influence. And if you think about their backgrounds and what they're trying to achieve, she almost couldn't help it.
Yeah, you know, they're both using American folk music as a basis for those compositions, I guess.
Yeah. Or that influence over a basic Austro-Germanic model for a symphony.
Well, let's hear a little music. Let's hear from the first movement of the Symphony Number 1, which gives you that sense that we're talking about. And the other thing I noticed about our music, it has a great sense of charm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, let's hear music from the first movement of the First Symphony by Florence Price, is played by my guest today, music director of the Fort Smith Symphony, John Jetter, as their latest recording on the Naxos label, featuring the music of African-American composer Florence Price. Here's music by my guest today, the music director of the Fort Smith Symphony, John Jetter, with the Fort Smith Symphony from their latest recording of the music of African-American composer Florence Price, music from her Symphony Number 1. Now, the recording features the Symphony Number 1, but also the Symphony Number 4, which is also her very first recording of this. And this piece has a very interesting backstory, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, we were the first orchestra. We actually did the world premiere performance of this work back in May of last year. And this is the first recording of her Fourth Symphony. In 2009, a family purchased land and a house, and I think there's a couple of like guest homes in a community kind of near Chicago. And it was an old dilapidated house. And as they were looking through everything, these folks noticed boxes of music that was, in many cases, actually water damage. There was a hole in the roof of that room. But this family noticed all this manuscript, and it had the name Florence Price on it. And they could have easily just said, this is old, moldy music. Let's just toss it out. But they did a little research, and they noticed that because of Price's roots, there was this archive of music at the University of Arkansas. They contacted the university, and the university is now in possession of a number of pieces in manuscript form of hers, including this Fourth Symphony. So it is very completely realistic to say that this Fourth Symphony that folks can hear on the recording was just so close to literally just being thrown out in the garbage. And we're so happy that it survived. I first saw it at the University of Arkansas Special Collections. It's completely handwritten, and it's generally very nicely handwritten, completed score. As you start to look really closely, I'm sure there were some things she would have revisited, and there's some things where we had to make a lot of decisions. You know, you're looking at handwritten stuff. So is that a B or a C? If that's an E flat, well, no, that could be a natural sign. You know, there's a lot of that sort of thing. But we were so fortunate, and it was so fun to perform it. There's no history of the piece. There's no performance history. There's no reference recording or anything. And it's a terrific piece. And we loved exploring this piece for the first time.
Now, why would she write a symphony? I mean, this is a major effort for a composer if it was never to be performed or was never going to be performed. Do we know why she wrote it?
No, we have no idea. And that's why would she write this if there were no pending commission? Why would she write it when maybe she, although she had gotten some orchestral performances, she hadn't had a lot of opportunities to do so. Why did she write this symphony when she informed some, I forget who the letter was to, but she had written a letter, I think sometime around or after that time, talking about her compositions, and she mentions that she had composed four symphonies. Why did she write the fourth symphony when, as far as we know, the second symphony has not been completed? We've only seen part of the first movement. So we don't really have any idea. And it's a lot of work to write a symphony just for the heck of it.
No kidding.
It sort of adds to the intrigue of it.
It does. Was there any signs in the archives that said maybe she was doing it on spec, or was she writing it for some sort of composition? Or, you know, I mean, it was written in 1945, and you think of all the commissions that were coming for American music at that time because of the war. You know, there were composers writing American music as almost a propaganda, patriotic sort of thing. Why would she write this if there was no pending performance? It's a mystery.
I'm open to people's ideas. It does, based on her compositions, she is certainly exploring some new harmonic ideas. Things are getting, a lot of the harmonies are getting a little edgier. She's also, I think, becoming a little more urban in her language. And she may have felt like it was time to explore that more. There's some of this in the third symphony. You can hear the progression in her third symphony. In fact, the third symphony, as my understanding, is going to be performed a lot next season by orchestras around the country. But it's so hard to say. There's nothing, we haven't seen anything in the archives that shows that it's any sort of a commission or anything like that. So yes, it really is a mystery. I guess we're enjoying not knowing. And I suppose from an interpretive example, it also kind of maybe frees us up a little bit. We're coming at this totally just from what's on the page. So I guess not knowing, we're trying to look at that as a positive in some way as performers.
I thought that was really interesting because listening to the recording, there's moments where I think as a conductor, you had some real decisions to make, like in the third movement Juba dance, which we may want to talk a little bit about how she would put these Juba dances in her symphonies. But you could interpret it almost as 20s, I don't want to say jazz, but sort of jazz influenced. Or you could play it very straight like a cakewalk. And I think there were a lot of interpretive choices because there's a sort of a foot, maybe even a toe in sort of several different pools.
Yeah, that's true. One of the nice things with this recording, and I think one of the things that made the recording itself work out so well, is we did an All Florence Price concert literally the day before the recording session. So we had our usual classical series rehearsal sequence to not only rehearse this music, but try things. And I know in the Juba dance in the fourth symphony, we tried some different tempos, tried maybe changing the tempos within certain sections as the character changed. But as we progressed, we sort of felt like ultimately there was kind of a tempo choice that worked pretty well for like a much larger section, just in terms of tempo. As far as the character of the pieces, we really tried to have performances. Sometimes when you're involved in the recording process, things can get really careful because, of course, it's a recording. So at some point, you hope that every measure can be played at least once perfectly, right, for the microphone. But sometimes, and this happens with any and every orchestra you can think of, sometimes there's a little bit of caution kind of get into that. We totally didn't want to do that. We felt like, particularly in the case of these Juba dances, interpretively, I think they need to be fun, happy dances, and they're so different. They fill the spots that the scherzo would do in a regular Austro-Germanic symphony. In terms of their feel, they couldn't be any further away from that sort of angsty Austro-Germanic scherzo, and it's supposed to be that way. The Juba dances, they're in both symphonies. They're maybe the most American moment. And a Juba dance, it's a slave dance. It's related to the ham bone. And if you ever seen people do the ham bone, there are folks who are basically playing percussion by slapping, tapping themselves as body percussion. So it's kind of that real sort of folkish feel. And in the case of the Fourth Symphony, you have that folkish feel combined with a very sophisticated urban jazz, and that what's called a jungle style, that of course was made so famous by Duke Ellington.
Yeah, and yet at times it also has a sort of a cakewalk feel, which again, that was very popular in the 19th century.
Debussy doing
cakewalks in the early 20th century. So it almost has that feel as well.
Yeah, exactly. How can you, that's pretty good if you think about it as a composer. We've just talked about all these different kinds of dances that are in these two dances that are in fact ultimately slave dances.
Right.
So yeah, she really, there's quite a bit of compositional skill there actually. It's pretty, and it was fun to do. And of course in the Juba in the First Symphony, there's actually a brief passage for slide whistle.
I did hear that.
Slide whistle. And it was funny. We actually went out and bought some different slide whistles and tested them. I mean, that's crazy. Symphonic slide whistle. We had to kind of decide which sound we liked more. I mean, that's ridiculous.
That's funny.
But it was fun to do. It was fun to do. I forget which one we went with. We went with the most expensive one, of course.
Of course.
Yes, of course.
The other thing I found really interesting was her use of folk melodies and spiritual melodies. I was thinking, I think it's in the slower passion or more lyrical section of the Juba dance in the Fourth Symphony. I swear I'm hearing Wayfaring Stranger, or there's another spiritual that has almost the same melody that it just seems like, you know, and you can hear little fragments of spirituals through both of these symphonies.
Right, and there's references, and there's also her sort of made-up references. The biggest one is in the first movement of the Fourth Symphony. That's Wade in the Water. It's really very prominent. And I think that's her saying, okay, I'm still working on this Austro-Germanic model. I've added those blues and jazz and spiritual harmonies to it, to my language. You know, how can I even add another sense of America to it? And that's a perfect way to do it. And you have this wonderful sort of symphonic statement frequently in the first movement of Wade in the Water. And it's just this great sort of American stamp that goes on the music. That's undeniable. If you're listening to, if you just turn on the radio and this is on, I think anyone's going to say, oh, that's an American symphony.
My guest today is John Jetter, the music director of the Fort Smith Symphony. The orchestra has just released their fourth recording on the Naxos label, featuring the music of African-American composer Florence Price, including the very first recording and perhaps the first performance when they did it live of the Symphony No. 4 by Florence Price. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. At the very top, I mentioned the fact that the orchestra has been publicizing the music written by African-American composers from the first half of the 20th century, three recordings of the music of William Grant Still, and now this recording of Florence Price. You know, when you look at recordings of William Grant Still, Florence Price, you're maybe looking at a handful. You're doing new recordings in this recording. Tell me why this is important for the orchestra to embark on this particular mission.
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, right now in our society in general, you can pick whatever sort of subspecies of our society in terms of if it's in the entertainment world or in the art world or in the political world or in the educational world, whatever. Gender and inclusion is front and center. And that's how our society is progressing. And there's a lot of great dialogue about making sure that everyone's voice is heard equally. And in the classical music world, which has traditionally been the slowest to really embrace any sort of change of any kind, it's now being discussed. And I think it's very important to realize that there's a heck of a lot of music out there that's really excellent by a lot of composers who aren't your typical Austro-Germanic guy. You know, and I mean, I love Tchaikovsky and Brahms and Mahler, but there's a lot of other people out there. And as an American orchestra, I know all of us at the Fourth Smith Symphony feel very strongly that we need to be playing American composers and bringing new composers into the fold as much as we can. We're Americans. That's what we're supposed to be doing. But take that a step even more locally. We feel really strongly that our state of Arkansas, and really most states, if one does the research, have really interesting musical histories. So for us, part of our job also is to promote the music of our state. And it's funny, I'm sure nationally when people think of Arkansas, I don't know what they think. I don't know if I want to ask sometimes, but you wouldn't think off the top of your head that Arkansas has a symphonic tradition. When in fact, in terms of African-American composers, concert composers who received recognition as being significant composers, we have the first male and first female composers here. William Grant Still, I just want to clarify, yes, he was born in Mississippi, but he moved to Arkansas when he was 4. So we've sort of stolen him a little bit. So for us, it's that state history. It's, I guess, the national part of doing American music. It's the sign of the times that we need to be looking at different types of music. There's a lot of interest, actually, in repertoire that we don't normally do. And we've kind of, I think as an orchestral community, have gotten in that rut a little bit of playing it safe all the time. Oh. So this is part of that overall philosophy that's just ours, to the very least. And that's why a project like this is so much fun to do. It's a great, you know, we sort of feel duty-bound to do it and feel lucky to be able to do it.
Well, John, congratulations on the recording, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
John Jetter is the music director of the Fort Smith Symphony, which has just released its 4th recording on Naxos Classics, featuring the music of Florence Price, African-American female composer, her Symphony No. 1, and the recently rediscovered Symphony No. 4. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We're going to leave you with music from that newly rediscovered Symphony No. 4. This is the Juba Dance with the Fort Smith Symphony. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.